Welcome to Battery Generation, your electromobility podcast for European battery research. We have a great topic for today's show. We're talking about battery talent with Dr. Billy Wu. Welcome.
Thanks for having me back.
Billy, you are a reader, associate professor, and director of research in the Dyson School of Design Engineering at the Imperial College London.
CATL, the largest Chinese battery manufacturer, employs approximately 20,000 battery experts. If you compare that to European battery manufacturers, rough estimations assume between 30,000 and 40,000 battery experts currently working in the field of batteries. Billy, what do these numbers tell us?
In our future, where we see electric vehicles, batteries on the grid, we're going to have many batteries powering them. And to make those batteries and to develop future batteries, we inevitably need the skilled people to do that. And within China, so companies like CATL, they've always had this kind of long-term vision and understanding of how to actually go from research and development to a commercial product. So the numbers that you quote there are impressive in terms of the volume of people there, and it highlights the scale of the challenge. If you don't have the people, then you don't have the driving force to kind of commercialize, develop, and so on. So it does kind of highlight one of the key things that we don't often talk about, where people talk about setting up gigafactories, but what about the people that will go into building the factories, developing them, research and development? So I think it's a bit of a wake-up call to say, hey, look, we need all these skilled people. Where are they actually going to come from? What are the skills that they need? So I'm super keen and a champion for making sure that we have the people to drive forward this field.
What do you see as the key factors contributing to the current shortage of battery talent in Europe?
Firstly, I think there are many talented people there. I think the battery field is going to grow. It might not be a linear route. It might be a bit non-linear in terms of bumpiness. And we do have to be careful about that. In terms of training people up, they will naturally go into jobs. And we've seen some very high profile instances where companies have gone out of business. I think that's a shame. That's naturally one of those growing pains which an industry like batteries is likely to have. So in addition to training the people, we also need to make sure our industry is resilient to some of these shocks, because I do think in the long term that we are going to need all of these different people. To your question of what is the cause of that shortage of talented people, of course, there are people out there, but do they have the right skills? I think it partly comes from the inertia that we have in our educational system. To set up a new degree in batteries is not something that we do very rapidly at universities, at least. So we probably spend a year articulating the business case for why that's needed. We recruit for the people. And if you're doing a master's, it can be 4+ years before you get the outputs for that. So there's a lot of inertia. I think we often wait until there's demand, but sometimes you need to kind of plan for that demand in the future. So as we go into this future, which is likely to be very turbulent in terms of what the industry is doing, I think we also need to think about how we develop skills. I'm a big champion and big believer in new ways of delivering education. So online courses like MOOCs, which are massively open online courses, I think they allow for asynchronous learning, where we all learn at different rates, also allowing for reskilling, that if you've got a lot of experience in one field, such as internal combustion engine, actually there's a lot of knowledge around heat transfer, chemical processes that you can transfer to batteries. But are there the resources out there available to allow people to kind of take their learnings, acquire new learnings? Because we often think that maybe once you leave university that your learning stops. Well, actually, I would encourage us to think that it's continuous learning and new skills there. So here in the UK, we have something called the Faraday Institution. I chair the training and diversity panel there. And one of the things that we released recently was something called the Faraday Institution Careers Portfolio. And it's this idea that in your lifetime, you'll likely move around different job roles. And we want to highlight the diversity of roles. There can be business development, there can be scientific R&D, there can be management there. And each one of those different roles requires different skill sets. And we want to kind of highlight and provide opportunities for people going into those roles as well.
So interesting to hear in general, but let's go two steps back here, Billy. battery science, of course, is a very interdisciplinary field in general. In this podcast, we talk to chemists, we talk to people that develop models, for example, to engineers. What is the battery field made of? What different jobs are we talking about in general?
I think the battery industry is very diverse. When you look at the supply chain, we've got miners extracting minerals, and we do need new technologies for extracting those materials and processing them into single crystal, polycrystalline materials. We've got people making them into cells, so you need manufacturing understanding. And maybe there's a big gap there, that in the universities, we're not particularly well set up for large-scale manufacturing. And actually, there's a lot of really interesting science behind how you mix active materials, how do you coat them, how do you dry them. And I think if we can solve that, that will maybe address some of the failing gigafactories we have within Europe, because that is a massive skill shortage. I do think we can learn from other fields where actually some of these problems around drying electrodes has probably been investigated in other fields, such as the paint industry. A battery is not too dissimilar to a paint in terms of having solvents, binders, and so on. So we should acknowledge those transferable skills a bit more. But going up into actual implementation, I think there's a lot more engineering in those systems. So basically, battery pack design requires thermal management, electrical engineers. And I think one of the challenges is that some of those skill sets, such as electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, and so on, they haven't traditionally taught electrochemistry as part of their curriculum. Certainly in the material science and chemistry fields, electrochemistry is taught a lot more. And that's why within the more R&D level where we're synthesizing new things, I wouldn't say we don't have a shortage of talent there, but it's less of a problem than in some of the engineering-orientated ones from my perspective, where I think we do see a real shortage there. And that's partly because it's not ingrained in some of the undergraduate or master's levels programs that we have producing the volumes of engineers and scientists right now.
Let's go back to you mentioning the automotive industry. You are someone who is into thermal management for battery systems. Of course, Germany is a country of engineers, and there's lots of engineers that work in thermal management of combustion engines. Why don't we just transfer all these people to battery science? How hard is that?
Certainly, we would welcome those people coming into the field, and certainly we have many of those people there. I think the challenge is that batteries, as you've alluded to, is very interdissciplinary. Not only do we need to dissipate the heat when we're fast charging our battery, but we also need to look at and understand how that heat's distributed, what impact does that have on the electrochemical performance. So we need the engineers to base and scientists to be able to speak to each other. We've seen in the modeling industry that we often have different length scales of people doing ab initio, atomistic modeling, continuum modelers and different types of modelers. And even within that field, we speak different languages. And now we're starting to blend different fields together, such as electrical engineers, which do more control-orientated problems. So there does need to be a soft skill around how do you take your fundamental challenges and abstract that into a common language. And that's where the way we teach battery science and engineering maybe has to change a little bit. Traditionally, you might have had ways of teaching which are what we call didactic, i.e. you come to a lecture and I speak to you, and that's fine. But because battery science is so interdisciplinary, you might need more problem-based or challenge-based problems where you bring together people from different disciplines. And instead of just saying, you've got a tutorial sheet, solve this problem, solve for X, you actually give them a real-world problem. Actually, teamworking skills is a very tangible thing, which maybe we don't acknowledge enough.
That brings me to a question that to really be able to build batteries, to develop the skill set and expertise, you probably just need to build batteries, right? But with all these gigafactories being cancelled and generally not there being a huge battery industry, isn't that kind of a catch-22? Like, we need the factories to develop the skill set, but we need the skilled people to fill the factory, right? Where do we start?
I think that's a huge chicken and egg problem that many battery scientists have never set foot into a battery factory. And you start to see so many of the challenges that we haven't really looked at. I think that's the reality of gigafactories is that I do believe they'll likely always be very expensive in nature. But I do think there's some really interesting opportunities in digital technologies where you can create virtual environments which start to give people a feel for equipment. So here at our university, workshop equipment, often that can be relatively inaccessible in terms of at scale. And we started trialing different VR, AR type technologies, which allow students to kind of get a feel for some of those challenges there. So I think opening out the modes of engagement or modes of learning beyond just having a lecture here and there, I think that's really exciting. Team-based learning that you learn from others, I think it's kind of a shift in thinking about how we learn about skills.
I bet there is new study programs out there in Britain. You just talked about the Faraday Institution. Where do I basically start when I'm really interested in batteries, but I don't really know whether it's chemistry to start or math or let's say any other engineering part? There's many ways how I can get into battery research. What do you recommend? Where can I start my studies?
My recommendation for people getting into the field is actually now with things like YouTube, MOOCs like Coursera and whatnot, you can actually, for very relatively low cost, if not free, get access to some quite high quality content around battery chemistry, battery control, and so on to kind of see if that's the sort of interest that you have. Obviously, beyond that, there's a lot of technical depth with textbooks and other activities that you can do. But I think that ability to kind of scan the field first and then specialize is quite a useful and productive approach.
We talked about the automotive industry. And so the question comes to mind whether our companies should play a more active role in allowing this kind of shift and training new talent to work in the battery field, since most of our manufacturers will rely on battery technology in the future.
My feeling is that what we need in the long term is an integrated approach between universities, governments, and industries. What's happening right now that I'm observing is that we have university graduates which leave. They've got very good technical understanding and they go into an industry partner. They then spend significant time either on their grad program or in specialist trainings, which maybe they provide themselves or pay an external company to kind of come in and provide. And that can be a significant investment from the company. If that person leaves, and then there's a challenge there in terms of their investment there. So I do think if everyone contributes to this united vision of kind of providing resources, knowing where their strengths are, and just acknowledging that we're all contributing to the field, that ultimately will allow the field to be a lot stronger in the long term. That's what we're trying to achieve with a combination of foundational teaching at undergraduate level. So there might be things that are common, such as I think programming skills are becoming more and more relevant in all industries, not just computer sciences, but also chemistry and so on. How can we teach that? Electrochemistry. Are there foundational skills that we can teach? And obviously within companies, they might have specialist skills that they can upskill specifically. But that's kind of more the cherry on top rather than the substance of the actual cake itself.
One key aspect of the training of battery scientists or battery engineers might actually be, we have covered this in this podcast, that European, in your case British, in our case German engineers would visit a Chinese battery company or manufacturer that actually produces in Germany, in Europe, or even in China for a while and then brings in this know-how to our home companies. Is that an approach that might work?
Hopefully in the future, internationally, we're more collaborative. I think right now is a very turbulent time, but certainly there's a lot of benefit from learning from each other, and we highly encourage that. Certainly the hub of knowledge around battery manufacturing is certainly in China right now, and many Chinese companies are setting up factories in Europe and beyond. So there is that opportunity for knowledge sharing. I think as well, going back to my point around in the future, I'm sure there will be more black swan events where unexpected things occur, and we need to make sure that we're resilient to that. So how do we ensure that the knowledge we acquire in people is sufficiently retained in the company as well? I think that's an important consideration, especially for smaller companies, which maybe don't have, you know, the tens of thousands of people that CATL naturally do. So that's a call to the industry to kind of think about how we retain knowledge, how does that kind of move around, and how do we upskill people?
We just learned from you a lot of new ideas of how learning can happen. It can be VR, it can be YouTube, it can be MOOCs, it can be learning on the job, maybe even working in another factory. Now, there's one big player also entering the game, also changing up the game for everyone in this century, which is AI, right? Where do you see the role of AI and digitalization changing the field? Do we see faster research? Do we see faster production? And can we maybe even at some point compensate for the lack of personnel, the lack of talent?
Excellent question. And I think it's probably one of those crossroads which doesn't come along often in terms of AI being a technology which can transform everything. Within education, I think universities are still kind of grappling with how to handle AI. I think we've gone through a phase where there was this kind of resistance to AI, where traditionally we do things like you write a report and we mark it. And right now, ChatGPT and other large language models are very good at producing that. So it poses the question of what are we actually trying to assess in our students? And I think we need to be leading with, if everyone in the future had these AI tools, what more can we achieve? Because historically, what we've always been bad at in terms of educational institutions is feedback to people, because it's limited by my time or the teacher's time. And the reality is AI really changes that problem, that it's no longer a bottleneck. So if someone has a question, they can get an instant response. So to that earlier point around reskilling people or transferring skills, I think it can be transformative. And we should embrace that. We shouldn't say, oh, people are trying to cheat the system. Actually, you know, we should be thinking about what could an augmented human actually achieve. So someone who has AI, and just, you know, imagining a future like that. So I personally think it's really exciting. I think we need to change the way we work right now. There are obviously challenges in terms of how we use these tools, in terms of you've got to be careful that if you put some information into some of these large language models, that information can be used. And then there are new challenges around confidentiality and so on. But certainly we shouldn't shy away from this, because I do think AI is only going to increase in use.
We know a lot of examples how AI can help researchers in speeding up their research discovery in terms of battery materials, for example. But do you have some other examples within the battery field how we can cope with a shortage of battery talent through AI?
I think we should think about what people are good at and what people are bad at, and also how the battery industry works. So to give you an example, a PhD student who is becoming a future leader in batteries, I think their main value is their intellectual curiosity, their ability to explore. But when you see how a PhD student might spend their time, they might spend many hours in a glove box making a few coin cells, and many of those coin cells might not even work, and there's huge variability in that. AI is actually a huge field. So we've got large language models, and we've just talked about the ability of that to help us program, explore the space, and so on. I think when you start to give AI the ability to actuate or do things, that can be really powerful. So here at Imperium, we've just set up a new robot that basically makes coin cells. And you can start to, instead of making 10 cells a day, you can make 1,000 cells a day. So you can start to explore the chemical space a lot more rapidly, and you can start to iterate automatically. So you make a cell, you test it, you see if it matches up with simulations, because the challenge with simulations is that all models are wrong to a certain degree, but some models are useful. So we need to be able to test some of the outcomes and then feed that back in. And I think that can be a very powerful conceptual framework to accelerating the way we do research. So often, people might make a singular battery and have no statistical significance. So I think statistical significance is something we need to talk more about in batteries. And now with the advent of robotics with AI, I think that's very powerful. And that's one way we can do it. Beyond that, I think it can really enhance the techniques that we've got. So some of my colleagues here at Imperial, they're working at existing techniques such as a microscopy and whatnot. Can we use AI to basically achieve super resolution of these techniques? And that can be really powerful alongside of approaches like large-scale simulations. So if you're simulating an entire vehicle, those simulations traditionally take a long time. And right now, we can use approaches such as surrogate model models, where we use the AI to learn some of the governing equations, and we can simulate essentially the same thing, but at a fraction of the time. And that can be quite transformative in terms of the speed at which we can iterate.
You just mentioned the word super resolution. Can you just explain what you mean by that in the context of batteries?
This is some work from a colleague of mine, Sam Cooper, where as we design batteries, we want to characterize them by understanding the structure of the material, the porosity, and other physical and chemical properties. Now, there are a range of techniques that we can use. We can use techniques such as scanning electron microscopy, or SEM, where we put the battery material into an electron microscope, and we can look at that. The problem with that technique is that it only tells you the surface morphology. You can look deeper into it with different techniques, but it's traditionally a bit slow, but very high resolution. Now, alternatively, we can also use x-rays to look into our battery. So just like you would take an x-ray of your hand, you can take an x-ray of a battery. And there are companies now doing high throughput screening of batteries by x-raying them right now. But the challenge is the resolution. So what my colleague Sam Cooper is working on is there a way to use AI to basically learn some of the features, learn from the SEM images, and apply that to x-ray tomography images to achieve the resolution of what you would get in SEM, but with x-ray based techniques? And I think that's really powerful. And you can apply that thought process to other areas of research as well. And I think that's quite powerful.
Do you think there's any field within the battery research fields that are free of AI in the future?
I do think because of the transformative elements of AI, it is likely to disseminate into all of those different fields there. So I struggle to think of a field which won't be touched by AI in the future. Maybe there will be some niche ones where I do think to a certain extent there humans will still play a role. So I don't think it will replace all of our jobs. It will just purely enhance what we do.
I'm asking that because it's quite important for us to integrate AI lectures in basically every battery education program, right?
Yes, and I think it's important to do that to kind of understand the limitations and also the challenges with the technology. It's not a silver bullet in terms of, I do some editorial work for journals and whatnot, and there is a prevalence of kind of applying machine learning everywhere. Sometimes it's not the best technique, and there are other techniques beyond machine learning as well, and we want to acknowledge that. I do think right now, the machine learning techniques that we have, in reality, they are the worst that they're ever going to be, and they're only ever going to increase in performance, hopefully. So I do think we need to be thinking of what AI can do right now, but what it might do in the future and what that might mean for skills, jobs, and how we approach the battery industry.
How would you say does Europe compare to other regions like Asia or maybe the United States in terms of battery talent development?
In terms of China, because they have had this strategically important area of batteries for such a long time, they've invested and they are producing a huge volume of very good engineers. I think the European and North American areas, we are very good at producing high quality researchers who essentially try a lot of novel ideas, but maybe have challenges in terms of commercializing those areas. I think in some areas, some of the researchers work extremely hard. Maybe in Europe, we take a bit more of a balanced work-life approach. So you do see some very different cultural differences in the way that we approach the battery industry from academia, which then gets disseminated into the industry culture. I think European companies and Chinese companies often do have different cultures. But to your question, I think there's a volume question, and then there's also the way we approach problems in terms of trying new things and whatnot.
What do you think compared to the United States? How are they doing lately in attracting battery talents from Asia, probably from the big companies such as CATL or BYD? Are the Americans doing a better job than the Europeans in attracting these talents?
I think talent gets attracted to interesting problems. And I think with companies like Tesla, they've set very ambitious stretch goals. And I think for a long time, people have been attracted to those problems. And I do think really smart people will seek out big challenges. You know, what SpaceX is doing is really, really impressive. And naturally, they attract the best people. Obviously, beyond that, there are other factors which influence where talent goes in terms of salaries, in terms of the geopolitics of what's going on there. I won't comment on this because I don't think battery generation is around politics, but I do think they have an influence. And things like visas and other things, they do have a strong influence on where people go as well. I think there are some headwinds in that sense because of what's happening in the world right now in terms of attracting that talent.
So Billy, you have talked a lot about resilience, how to build up battery companies in Europe with a battery talent that we have here. Let's talk about this startup, Ecure. What's so fascinating about this small startup from Germany is that they sit here in Germany, but basically sell their businesses worldwide and are basically, well, a niche business, but still it's applicable for everyone out there, right?
What Ecure doing is very interesting. So battery intelligence, that as we deploy more and more of these batteries into the real world, we care about the lifetime, the safety, and so on. And the reality is how these batteries degrade and how safe they are depend on how you use them. If you have a battery close to a fire, it's likely to be very dangerous. So we need to be able to monitor these things, and that is something that is general to all battery chemistries, not specific. So you're not just placing all your bets on one chemistry or one specific application. So I think it is good to have that resilience that you can adapt to different industries. So marine, automotive, aviation, they all share this kind of challenge of how do we control our batteries. And I do think it's niche in one sense that you aren't trying to solve all the problems, but you're trying to be the best in terms of diagnosing the battery. And niche isn't always bad. I think actually it allows you to be a specialist in an area, produce a good business case, which is profitable. And then once you've got that, disseminate it around the world and then build from strength to strength rather than trying to go for this very difficult big problem all at once. So I think it's great to see. It just highlights again that to be successful, not only do you need good ideas, you need the business case behind it to get in the revenue to pay your employees so that it can afford rent and food and everything.
Exactly. And the resilience part, I thought the key element of founding a company over here is also that you kind of building the battery industry structure, you know, a company would then attract another one. And that's how we actually can build up an entire battery industry at some point.
Exactly. And I think there's a real risk that at the beginning, if you don't have that ecosystem, it can kind of stutter. I think with the example you spoke about earlier, Northvolt, one of the real shames, I think they built fantastic teams there and they had some very talented people. And inevitably, some of those might be leaving the battery industry. And I think that's a real shame there just because they need jobs to kind of pay for things. And there aren't that many battery gigafactories out there. Maybe they will find employment in the battery industry, but certainly I suspect some will leave the industry.
Thank you very much for your time and expertise. That was Dr. Billy Wu. You are Associate Professor and Director of Research in the Dyson School of Design Engineering at the Imperial College London. Dear listeners, if you are interested in now studying battery research, down below, beneath this podcast, we have placed some links if you're interested. Take care. See you next time. Bye-bye.